Well, a few weeks ago now, we looked at the topic of prayer, and now we're back here again as we go through Mark, as Jesus has this encounter with this man and his young boy. So we have to ask, how important is prayer in the life of a disciple of Jesus Christ? How important is prayer in the life of a disciple of Jesus Christ? To make it more personal, how important is prayer to you? How important is prayer to you? You know, regardless of how you might answer that question, no doubt you feel my prayers need improving. There is room to grow. But how am I going to do that? How are we going to improve and pray as we ought? What we're going to do today, we're going to look at this encounter that Jesus had with the crowd and with this man and his boy. And after going through this, then I'm going to talk about three different observations we can pull from this text to help us to pray as we should. So let's start at the very beginning. Let's look at verse 14 and 15 in Mark chapter 9. And when they came to the disciples, they saw a great crowd around them and the scribes arguing with them. And immediately all the crowd, when they saw him, were greatly amazed and ran up to him and greeted him. So Andrew Relly pointed out that they have just come down from the Mount of Transfiguration, where Jesus has been transfigured in front of Peter and James and John, and now they're coming down the mountain. It's been quite a ways to get up there and to come down. So the rest of the disciples were on their own when Jesus and the inner three were gone. And so they were left to be on their own and to defend themselves amongst the crowd and the scribes and the Pharisees. And things were not going too well whenever Jesus came back. Now, remember in chapter 6, Jesus gave his disciples authority to cast out demons and to heal the sick, to anoint them with oil and to heal them. So Jesus gave them the authority to demonstrate that he is the king, and in himself the kingdom of God is here. And that these things that we see in the future promised of no death and of no suffering and of no blindness, of no lameness, is happening right now in Jesus' ministry because he's the king, as we get a glimpse of that future glory of the kingdom. And he's given his disciples the authority to cast out demons and to heal the sick. And so as they come down the mountain here, there's quite the commotion going on. And so as we get to the next verse, we find out exactly what's happening. But you see, this commotion is going on. But when the crowd sees Jesus, in verse number 15, they're greatly amazed. They ran up to him and greeted him. They're happy now that Jesus is here. This is the person that they've all been waiting for. And so as we look at verse number 16 to 18, let's continue to lay out the setting of what's happening here. So verse number 16, it says, and he asked them, so Jesus asked them, what are you arguing about with them? And so the disciples and the scribes and Pharisees, they're arguing, and Jesus asking, what are you arguing about? And then in verse 17, and someone from the crowd answered him, teacher, I brought my son to you, for he is a spirit that makes him mute. And whenever it seizes him, it throws him down, and he foams and grinds his teeth, and he becomes rigid. So I asked your disciples to cast it out, and they were not able to. Okay, so we have quite the scene as Jesus comes down and asks, what's going on here? So you have the disciples in a fight, going back and forth with the scribes and Pharisees. You have this man coming out of the crowd and saying, I asked them to heal my boy, and they were unable to cast the spirit from him. And so the disciples are now really wondering what is happening, that they don't have this authority now to cast out this unclean spirit. And you have the five scribes and Pharisees, no doubt, heckling them and jeering them on and mocking them, saying that you guys are a bunch of phonies and fakes. We have the crowd all around there wondering what's happening. We came to see miracles. What's going on here? And so you can imagine the state of mind of the disciples and how thankful they were to finally see Jesus come here and say, finally, someone who can speak and who can close the mouth of these skeptics and these scribes and Pharisees who are mocking and jeering us, and someone who can heal this boy and satisfy the needs of this father, and that can explain to us why we can't cast this demon out. And so we get to the next verses here, 19 to 22. And it says this. So Jesus gets a bit of what's going on, and he says in verse number 19, he answered them, "O faithless generation, how long am I to be with you? How long am I to bear with you? Bring him to me." And they brought the boy to him, and when the spirit saw him, immediately it convulsed the boy, and he fell on the ground and rolled about, foaming at the mouth. And Jesus asked his father, "How long has this been happening to him?" And he said, "From childhood, and has often cast him into fire and into water to destroy him. But if you can do anything, have compassion on us and help us." So what's Jesus' first response to all of these things that are going on, this big commotion? "O faithless generation." He's pointing out their lack of faith. That's going to be interesting as Jesus continues to develop this theme in this text, but his first thought is, where is your faith? "Have you not, you disciples, seen my power demonstrated over and over and over and over again? Have you crowds not witnessed my power? Scribes and Pharisees, why do you mock and jeer? Have you not witnessed my power?" You know the power of God is manifested, is here in my ministry. And so he calls the boy to himself. And immediately the boy begins to have a seizure. And so it convulses on the ground. It starts to foam and to do these behaviors right in front of him. And no doubt the father again is overcome with a sense of hopelessness. And is this ever going to stop? No doubt the boy was covered with scars and other markings, being thrown into the fire, being thrown into the water, having these seizures. And so not only was this boy mute, it says, but later in verse 25, we find out this is a mute and deaf spirit. So this boy couldn't speak. This boy couldn't hear. But he was suffering from these terrible seizures that would throw him and that would throw him into these different convulsions. And you can imagine just the heart of that boy's father. To have a boy who could not voice to him how much he hurt. And what was going on? He couldn't hear the voice of his father to comfort him, to tell him that he was trying to help him. Just hand signals and other ways to try to communicate to this young boy who was overcome by this evil spirit. And so this boy is now, this father now is, hope is running out as he seeks out someone who could help his boy and to remove this spirit from him, to stop these seizures from happening. And so in a last-ditch effort, he asked Jesus, "If you can do anything, have compassion on him." If you can do anything, have compassion on him. If you can help him, I'm asking you to do it. Now notice how when the boy comes to Jesus, how things get worse before they get better. You know how it is so often when we're determined to fight sin in our life, we're determined to pursue holiness, that things get worse? As Satan mounts up and tries to discourage us, to remove our hope. And you imagine that boy's father, as he brings this boy to Jesus, and then he begins to convulse, and you imagine his hopelessness would have even been greater. Now, this is so great what's happening to his boy. Satan attempts to do that to make things worse, to try to crush our faith, to try to destroy our hope, to try to take our minds off Jesus and the saving power of who he is. But then the boy's father and Jesus continue the story. Look at verse number 23 and 24. So the man in verse 22 has just asked Jesus to help him. And then in verse 23, "And Jesus said to him, 'If you can, all things are possible for one who believes.' Immediately the father of the child cried out and said, 'I believe, help my unbelief.'" You can imagine this man just at the end of himself. "I believe, help my unbelief." This boy, he's suffering from so much, and my hope is so low, my faith is so weak. Please help him. "I believe that you can do it. Help my unbelief. I'm doubting. Help my doubt." So before this man even cries that out, Jesus says this interesting phrase, if you can, he says, all things are possible for one who believes. Okay, so he's correcting this man's thinking here by saying it's not quite right to say, if you can. Obviously, I can do it. And there's a corrective here for us as well. Because some people, we have a tough time with prayer. Because we have some people who are professing Christians, and they say, well, if you, Jesus here himself says everything is possible for the one who believes. So if we just have enough faith, God will do it. You have to muster up enough faith. You name it, you claim it, God will do it. Okay, we've all heard about that. God is, in that case, more like a genie. It's in our court. The ball's in our court. There's power available, and we need to have the faith. The problem is between our ears. And if we have enough faith, God will do it. Okay? The corrective here, if we have a view like that, is just because God is able doesn't mean that he will. Okay? God is able. God has the power. So we should trust him. But we learn from Scripture that our wills do not dictate God's will. Okay, so that keeps us from having that God is a genie type mentality, name it and claim it type mentality. If you believe it enough, he will do it. Because we're forgetting that our wills do not trump God's will. God is a person. And at the other hand, as we tend to go away from that God is a genie, name it and claim it type mentality, we might go all the way over here and have this idea that whatever will be. And our prayers are in effect useless because God is sovereign. He has ordained the beginning from the end. And it's basically a mechanistic unfolding of events. And so our prayers don't really have an effect. We rightly believe that we can't twist God's arm. He's not going to submit to human will and human wisdom. You know, it's kind of like if you're in Ottawa there and you see some of the changing of the guard, those men with the big black furry hats, and sometimes when you go in front of them, they're rigid and they're firm. They do not move. They do not flinch. You go in front of them. You try to make them smile. You try to make them laugh. They're unflinching. They're unmoving. Except when that bell sounds, and all of a sudden they start doing the things that they were going to do. And to many of us, prayer has become something like that in our encounters with God. God is, he's firm, he's unchanging, he's not moving. And so why bother trying to communicate with him in prayer and ask him for things? It's going to happen the way that he's predestined for it to happen. But the corrective, if that is our thinking, the corrective is the same thing that corrects those who have the name it and claim it theology, is that God is a person. That God has a will, that he has emotions, that he has desires. Yes, he has a plan, but he is relational. We can't twist God's arm, but he wants us to ask and to communicate with him. And so the idea that God is a person helps us from falling back into this name it and claim it. And if we have enough faith, he will do it. Versus going back on the other way and saying, well, God is just going to do it, so I don't even need to bother asking. Not at all. God is a person. He corrects both of those false views, and he wants us to come to him and to come to him asking, come to him with faith, come to him with trust, come to him with hope and anticipation that he will answer. Okay? And that's what this man was coming to him, hope and anticipation that he will answer. And if we think of prayer, we can think of a child and a father. A child and a father. And that's how we should visualize our relationship with our Heavenly Father. And we can learn so much about our earthly relationship between a child and a father against our spiritual relationship with God the Father. A child has full confidence in his father's ability. And a child will tell his father everything and anything and ask for everything, even if it's not something that the father is going to do. It wasn't too long ago that it was an incredibly windy day, and Nathan called me and says, Daddy, can you make it stop? Turn off the wind. You know, obviously I can't do that. But he had full confidence that, you know, his daddy can do that. I just have to ask him. In the same way, we have the same attitude towards our father. God, you can do that. I'm going to ask you. I'm going to trust you. I'm going to bring you my cares and my requests, and I'm going to anticipate that you're going to answer. Okay? Children don't have the name it and claim it theology. If my boy come up to me and says, Daddy, I want that, and you're going to give it to me, I'm not going to honor that. You know? And the same thing, if my child was on the other side of this, reacting against that name and claim it and not ask me anything and not talk to me or not do anything because, well, Daddy's just going to do what Daddy does. Again, we can see the wrongness of that thinking. It's because both of them are persons. Child and father are persons. And so we communicate and the child cries out and he asks his father for help and he hopes and anticipates that his father will answer. Knowing at the same time that fathers have more wisdom than the son, and so they might not get the answer they're looking for, but the father has the best interests of the son in heart. And so this man here, as he brings his child toward Jesus, he has neither the name and claim it, neither the more of the God is a robot things will be. He says, I believe, help my unbelief. My faith is weak. I'm doubting, but I don't want to doubt. I want to trust you fully. I believe you can heal my boy, but I have questions. It's such a hopeless situation. I want you to heal him. Help my unbelief. And so we see that even his small faith that he had, his meager faith, was enough for Jesus to carry out this miracle. It wasn't a fact that he had no doubts in his mind and he was going to claim that miracle from God. No, he was full of doubts. He had a little faith, but God was pleased to answer his cry for help. Look at verse number 25. And when Jesus saw that a crowd came running together, he rebuked the unclean spirit, saying to it, You mute and deaf spirit, I command you, come out of him and never enter him again. And after crying out and convulsing him terribly, it came out, and the boy was like a corpse, so that most of them said, He is dead. But Jesus took him by the hand and lifted him up, and he arose. So Jesus, just like in past encounters, rebuking the unclean spirit, immediately it's gone. The spirit left kicking and screaming, but it was gone. Just like he calmed the wind and the waves, a word of his mouth, and the spirit was gone. The people thought that this boy had died. He was so still. But yet Jesus goes over, picks him up, and raises up this boy. The spirit is gone. The muteness is gone. The deafness is gone. A healing has taken place. And you can imagine the amazement of the crowds. And then look how the story continues here. In verse number 28. And when he had entered the house, his disciples asked him privately, Why could we not cast it out? And he said to them, This kind cannot be driven out by anything but prayer, or anything but by prayer and fasting. And so here, after this encounter has taken place, the disciples are alone with Jesus, and now they have an opportunity to ask, why couldn't we have done that? I thought we had the authority to do such things. Why couldn't we do it? And then Jesus says, this kind cannot be driven out by anything but prayer or by prayer and fasting. So what does he mean by this kind? This kind cannot be driven out by anything but prayer and fasting. He's speaking of just the nature of this unclean spirit. You know, this unclean spirit needed people who were dedicated to prayer and fasting. It wasn't anything particularly special. Jesus spoke the same words of this spirit that he spoke with those legion of spirits before. But he's telling the disciples that to minister in this way, you need to be a people of prayer and fasting. So why does Jesus mention prayer and fasting here? You know, he certainly didn't pray and fast right before he cast out this spirit. So why was he mentioning to his disciples here about prayer and fasting? There's nothing in this whole passage about prayer, and suddenly he mentions prayer in the end here. Well, this passage is about prayer. Because earlier in the passage, Jesus says, O faithless generation. And then he's asking about the faith of this man who wants his boy healed. And then he's telling his disciples that their faithlessness is showing up in a lack of prayer. And if you lack faith, you're going to lack prayer. And if you lack prayer, you're going to lack power. And so Jesus here has criticized their faith, and now he's criticizing their lack of prayer. You know, he wasn't just expecting them to say a quick prayer, okay, and that this demon is being especially difficult, so I'm going to say a quick prayer, and then I'm going to cast it out, and then that's going to work. This kind will come out by that kind of prayer. No, because that doesn't make sense. When Jesus says prayer and fasting, he doesn't expect them to say, okay, well, this boy, he obviously looks very difficult, and so we're going to go off and we're going to fast for the next day, and we'll come back here tomorrow, and then we can cast it out. That's not how Jesus' ministry is operating. It's not how it's operating in the past. What he's telling them is, your life as my disciples needs to be characterized by prayer and fasting. This needs to be part of your regular routine of seeking God and praying to him such that the power of God will be displayed among you. And so he's calling them to have an exercise, having a commitment to prayer, not just for a particular moment in their ministry, but as ministers of the gospel, as his disciples going out to do his work, they need to be a people of prayer. They need to be characterized as men of prayer. And as you think about the disciples in the gospels, what are they always doing when Jesus is praying? Sleeping. You know, they seem like they're always sleeping when Jesus is praying. And here, now that Jesus is gone, they've had some days by themselves, and what's wrong? Where's the power? They haven't been praying. They've been continuing that same practice of lazily not coming to God, or coming to God in a sleepy fashion. And so Jesus is saying that if you are going to be my disciples, you need to be people of earnest prayer. And that my power is not going to be manifested unless you are people of prayer. So as you look at this encounter with Jesus and his disciples, there's three important truths that we can learn from it. And they're in the back of your bulletin. And we're going to go through each one here quickly. So we're asking ourselves, what do we learn from prayer and faith from this passage, and how can we improve our prayer as our praying as disciples of Jesus Christ? Well, the first thing we should notice that this text teaches us is that a praying faith, or a faith that prays, faith that comes to God in prayer, that comes to God asking and expecting and hoping, a praying faith is born out of recognition that you are helpless and that you need Christ to rescue. Okay, that's the first thing that we need to realize. That kind of faith that is going to cause us to cry out to God in prayer is a faith that recognizes that we are helpless before God and that we need Christ's rescue. Then we will cry out to him in a praying faith. Look again at verse 22 to 24. In verse 22 in Mark 9, the Father says, And it has often cast him into fire and into water to destroy him. But if you can do anything, have compassion on us and help us. And Jesus said, if you can, all things are possible for the one who believes. Immediately the father of the child cried out and said, I believe, help my unbelief. And then when Jesus saw the crowd come running together, he rebuked the unclean spirit, saying to it, you mute and deaf spirit, I command you, come out of him and never enter him again. And so this man, as we've seen from this story, is completely helpless. There's nothing that he can do for his boy. There's nowhere else that he can take them to. And so what's that going to cause him to do? To cry out to God for help, to cry out for his son, Jesus Christ, to do something. And so he recognizes his need, and he pleads out his case. He asks for compassion. He asks for help, and he cries out, I believe, help my unbelief. I have a meager faith, but I recognize my need. I know my need. I know my helplessness. I know my hopelessness. And so I'm going to call out to you in faith. So what keeps us in prayer sometimes? Not recognizing our need. Not recognizing that we are a helpless and needy people. You know, if we think about our praying for a second, our current habits of prayer, what does that tell us about our faith? What does that tell us about our faith? Does it tell us that we have a great faith and a confidence in ourselves? That we are not taking things to God in prayer? Is that what that tells us? That we're not like this man and recognize our need and our hopelessness before God? Does our praying and our faith tell us this much? And so we can learn from this man that recognizing our need and our helplessness drives us to God in faith, drives us to Him in prayer. Or perhaps we do recognize our need and our helplessness, but we struggle like this man with the sufficiency of Christ, with His power to rescue, with His power to save, with His power to clean me, His power to meet my needs that I'm facing in my life at this point in time. And we have to remind ourselves, just like Jesus reminded this man here too, that all things are possible with God. All things are possible to the one who believes. Cry out to me, ask me. Put your meager faith in me, Jesus says. Remember, look at Jesus' track record. One word from His lips accomplished the calming of the wind and the waves. Power over nature, demonstrating that He's the Creator. One word from His lips. One word from His lips caused this unclean spirit to come out of this boy. To cause the spirits to come out of this, the legion of spirits, thousand spirits to come out of this man who was shackled and controlled by His unclean spirits. One word from His lips caused the lame to walk again, caused the blind to see, caused the deaf to hear, caused the mute to speak. One word from Jesus causes this. He says, have faith in me. I have the power to rescue. So perhaps we're not remembering Jesus' power. Perhaps we're not remembering the one word that came off from His lips when He hung on the cross was tetelestai, Greek meaning, it is finished. Perhaps we're not remembering the redemption and the power of canceled sin that was promised to us by God the Father through His Son, Jesus Christ. And when we're not remembering these things, we're not going to call out to Him in a praying faith. So when you do doubt, remember these things. When you do have fear, when you do have anxiety, remember that Jesus Christ is Lord of all, that He's the Lord of creation, that He's a person and that He has power. Believe it. Look into the Scriptures, look into the promises of the Scriptures, and believe it. Increase your faith. Cry out to Him, Lord, I believe, and help my unbelief. This is an important lesson we can learn from this man. We are not to have faith in ourselves in terms of, look at the great faith that I have. Sometimes we have faith in our own faith, or maybe have doubt in our own doubt. What I mean by that is because, well, I think my faith is not very weak and I'm so inward focused on my own faith and I'm so critical of my own faith that I'm not calling out to God to help my faith, to give me faith, to help my unbelief. God, I know it says in Your Word that I'm not supposed to be anxious. I know I'm not supposed to be fearful. I know I'm not supposed to be angry. I know I'm not supposed to be this unloving. I believe it, but help my unbelief. Because obviously I'm not living in accordance with what is written here. My faith is weak. Help me to believe what You have written. Help me to believe the promises of Your Word. Our faith is not in ourselves. Don't beat up on yourself because you feel, well, my faith is weak and my prayers are weak. That's not what gets us an ear with God. What gets us an ear with God is to come to Him and to cry to Him and to say, help me, I need help. Not, I need to muster up enough faith so I can come to You. I come to You with a weak and a meager and a low faith, and I don't pray as I should, and I want You to help me, God. That's the attitude that Jesus wants us to come to Him. Because we're coming to a person. We're not coming to a force or to a power that we're trying to enact in our life. We're coming to a person who has power, who has authority. And so even if our faith is weak, our prayers are weak, we come to Him and we ask Him to increase our faith, to make us a praying disciple. So the first thing we learn is a praying faith is born out of recognition of our own need and of the power of Christ to rescue and to redeem. The second thing, a praying faith is necessary to accomplish His purposes. A praying faith, a faith that prays, is necessary to accomplish the purposes of God. Now, when I say that, we might have an issue with how that's worded. What do you mean that a praying faith is necessary for God to accomplish His purposes? I thought that God was sovereign, that nothing can thwart His purposes. And that's true. And that's true. So how can I say a praying faith is necessary for God to accomplish His purposes? That seems to go against that. Before we talk about prayer, think about evangelism for a second. Think about evangelism. Think about Romans chapter 10. Paul in Romans chapter 10 describes this idea that people must call out to Jesus Christ in faith. They must confess Him and believe in his heart that He is Lord and that God has raised Him from the dead. If they don't do that, they're not going to be saved. And then he says, how are people going to call out for salvation unless they believe? That is, belief in the gospel is necessary before I can call out to Him for salvation. I need to believe that Jesus Christ is Lord. I need to believe that salvation is available in Him. I need to believe that His atonement is sufficient to forgive my sin. And I need to call out to Him. So belief is necessary for me to call out. And Paul says not only that, but how are people going to believe unless they hear? They need to hear. They need to have input coming in before they can believe in their heart. And he says, how are they going to believe unless they hear? And how are they going to hear unless someone preaches to them, unless someone proclaims to them, unless someone tells them the good news of Jesus Christ? And how is someone going to tell them the good news of Jesus Christ unless that person is sent? Unless they're equipped and trained by the church and sent out to proclaim the gospel. So what Paul is saying is, it is necessary for the church to send out people who can proclaim the gospel. It's necessary that people do proclaim the gospel so that people can hear, so that they can believe, so that they can call out to God for salvation. Is God sovereign in salvation? Absolutely, yes, without a doubt. Romans 9 is so clear in that. But Romans 10 tells us that what is necessary to God's saving work to save His people is people going out to proclaim the gospel so that people would hear and believe and call out on the Lord Jesus Christ. And the same is true with prayer. Prayer is necessary for God to accomplish His purposes. Part of His sovereign plan includes the prayer of His people. And so what do we learn from this passage? Where am I getting this from this text? In verse number 29, He says to His disciples, this kind cannot be driven out by anything but prayer. This kind cannot be driven out by anything but prayer. You could not do it because you did not pray. This boy was not healed because you were not men of prayer. A praying faith is necessary for God to accomplish His purposes. And if we think about it, there's a lot of things that we can do in our life without prayer. You know, we do these things. We can buy a new car. We can get a new job. We can go to the grocery store. We can do all these things without ever talking to God. And we think, well, we're just fine. We can do these things without prayer. And I think we're a bit naive if we can think that we can do all those things without prayer. But we can live our lives that way. But what this text is telling us here and what Jesus is teaching His disciples is that to be my disciple, nothing of eternal importance is going to get done unless you're a praying people. You are not going to see the power of God in your ministry unless you're praying. And so when the disciples asked, why couldn't we drive out this unclean spirit? Jesus answered them, you must pray. Why couldn't we do it? You must pray. We might be asking, well, why isn't our church growing and seeing the gospel go out? The same answer, you must pray. Why am I struggling with sin and not growing in holiness? You must pray. You must pray. The purposes of God are not going to be accomplished apart from praying disciples. You know, where is the love in the congregation? I'm not feeling the love of those around me. Again, we need to be people of prayer if we're expecting God to work in our midst. It's like trying to light a fire with no flame. It's like trying to start a car without a key or turn on the TV when it's not plugged in. Or trying to assemble IKEA furniture without instructions. These things can't be done. In the same way, apart from prayer, we will not be effective disciples of Jesus Christ. We'll be wondering, where is the power of God? Why couldn't we do it? Jesus says, you must pray. You must pray. The last thing in that sentence there, and the second point, a praying faith is necessary for God to accomplish His purposes. Perhaps we struggle with what prayer is all about because we're not actually seeking to accomplish God's purposes in our own life. We know what the Great Commission is, to go and to make disciples of Jesus Christ and to teach them to obey all that Jesus has taught. We know what that is, but if we're not doing it, then perhaps now we don't have impetus to pray. You know, our days are so filled with the temporal things that our life looks an awful lot like our neighbor, except that we're here on a Sunday morning, so why pray? What's the need of prayer? I'm getting along just fine the way that I am. Well, perhaps you're not involved in people. You're not involved in the life of the congregation. You don't know the people who are hurting and have needs and can pray for them and intercede for them. Or perhaps you're not involved, like I said, in the Great Commission. You're not involved in proclaiming the gospel and in thinking of deliberate ways that I can reach my family and unsaved loved ones around me. And so you don't pray because you're not trying to accomplish the purposes of God. John Piper famously called prayer a wartime walkie-talkie. And that has stuck in my mind forever. A wartime walkie-talkie. And what he means by that is, we as Christians are in a war. And prayer is our connection with God to call in the reinforcements, to bring the power of the Holy Spirit. As we're out as His soldiers and His disciples on the battlefield, in the church and beyond, to spread the gospel. Now, if we don't have that wartime, I'm a disciple of Jesus Christ mentality, well, we don't need a wartime walkie-talkie. That can just gather dust. And so I'm not going to call out to Him in a praying faith because I'm not actually accomplishing His purposes in my life. The third point. A praying faith brings the power of God. A praying faith brings the power of God. This passage teaches us what to pray for. The disciples were in the service of Jesus Christ. They were given a commission. They were given authority. They were to preach this gospel of the kingdom and to demonstrate its power as Jesus Christ has given them this authority. Now, we're not called. We don't have the exact same commission as these disciples. We aren't given the same authority and the same types of things that they were called to do. But yet, we were given the Great Commission. And we were given a task as a church and as people to be carrying out and to be asking God to accomplish His work through us. And so we are not going to see the power of God as we seek to fulfill the Great Commission unless we are people and disciples of prayer. They weren't praying and it didn't happen. The power of God wasn't displayed because they didn't have this faith-fueled prayer. And so we need to learn from their lesson, from what they've learned here, that we must be praying for the advancement of the gospel, that we must be praying not only for the entire world, but for our city, for our communities, for our families, for our homes, for our children, that the power of God would be demonstrated among us, that the power of God would be demonstrated in our homes as our children grow up, as they profess faith in Jesus Christ and become His disciples, and they choose to live a life of self-denial for the sake of Jesus Christ and the gospel. That's the power of God on display. And if we expect that to happen, we need to be people of prayer. This praying faith brings the power of God. This praying faith brings the power of God to convert a people from a people who are wicked and unregenerate to a people who are holy and are pure and who are zealous for good works. So we need to be praying for our own holiness and for the holiness of others around us. Because we realize that for our heart change, for our heart to love the things that God loves and to actually say no to sin and say yes to righteousness is something that is supernatural. That does not take place by trying to adopt some moralistic pattern or set of rules or anything like that. That requires a change of heart. Because that is a change that needs to take place in our character, our integrity. That is the power of God on display when someone is growing in holiness. And if we're not praying, we're going to be like disciples. Where's the power of God? Where's the power of God in my life to drive out sin and to become holy? Jesus says, you must pray. We need the power of God in our church for unity. For unity. One of the biggest problems in churches everywhere is divisions. God has united us together with the gospel. One Lord, one faith, one baptism, one God, Father, and all. All these things that Ephesians 4 talks about. There's a unity that God has created among us. And he calls us to maintain this unity. Now that is a supernatural act of God for us to be united in all fronts. Because we all come from different backgrounds. We have different ways of viewing different things. And it's so easy for us to be caught up in divisions. And so we need to be praying for the power of God to unite us. So this event teaches that if we expect to see the power of God for evangelism, for holiness, for unity, for a variety of things, we need to be praying. Otherwise, we'll be asking, where's the power of God? And Jesus says, you must pray and you must fast. You must have a faith that leads you to do these things. If we lack faith, we are going to be lacking in prayer and we're going to be lacking in the power of God and trying to accomplish his purposes. But if we have that faith-fueled prayer, that is going to lead to God's accomplished purposes and seeing the power of God on display in our midst. And I hope that fuels our hearts to have a deeper faith in God. That even in our weak faith right now, we cry out to him, I believe, but help my unbelief. I'm going to call out to you and say, I want to be better at prayer. I'm weak right now, but God, I want to believe more. Increase my faith. I pray that's our prayer here this morning. Let's close in a word of prayer.